Well, good morning, Bridgeway. Snow day. Wow, it seems like winter is here. It's arrived with a vengeance. And on behalf of the elder team, we thought it would be best, safest, to just do church online today. I hope you're doing well. I miss you. On behalf of the staff, we miss you. We miss seeing your families here. And so I hope you have a great day in the Lord. It's going to be a great day here with church online. We're going to kick off a brand new series as well. It's also Super Bowl Sunday. Doesn't get any better than that. Actually, I don't care. My teams aren't in it. But if you're rooting for the Bucks tonight, you're rooting with Dan Mack, our worship leader. He loves the Bucks. I got to say, though, I actually took the Chiefs. I'll go on record of saying the Chiefs plus 14. And by plus 14, I mean that's the number of wings I hope to eat tonight. Plus 14. We're kicking off this series called Own the Vision, and it's really a study in the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, if you've never read it, is a historical chronological account of God's people, the Israelites. And we're going to see that this story is really about cleaning up a mess. Let me ask you, have you ever been left a mess that you had to clean up? Someone else's mess? Maybe you're at work and a coworker resigns, and so your boss comes to you and says, here it is, here's the file of all the unfinished projects. This is your next big major to-do list. And you got to clean up the mess. Maybe you're a student, and you're assigned a team, a group project, dreaded words, right? And you see the team forming, and it's like, oh, no, not him, not her. They never pull their weight, and you're left cleaning up the mess. Maybe you're like me, and when I was in college, I had a roommate who never liked to do his dishes. He loved to create dishes. In fact, he was a really good cook. He would cook Italian red sauce, white sauce, lasagna, sausage, but he never did his dishes. And so one day another roommate and I decided we would teach him a lesson. So we took a huge stack of his dishes, mind you, in the sink. We brought them into his room and we threw them on his bed, all full of water and food and grease. And we didn't stop there. I'm not proud of this. But then we took his clothes and we threw his clothes on top. And then we took his blanket and his pillow. We threw them on top, messed it all up. Again, I wouldn't recommend this, but it was effective. He did his dishes after that. Nehemiah, you're going to see, is going to clean up a huge mess. And it's a mess that is 141 years in the making. And spoiler alert, he is going to clean this mess up in a mere 52 days. How, you might ask? Vision. Vision is going to get it done. Now, I've been trying to live in vision, trying to follow God's vision for all of my adult life, and there's a few things I've discovered. The first thing I would say is everyone has a vision. I mean, whether you know it or not, you are following and you have your eyes set on something. I mean, it might be that you are following your company's vision. You know, you're kind of towing the company line, or you're trying to create a vision for your own company to get off the ground. Maybe your vision is to get out of debt, and you're following Dave Ramsey, and you're taking baby steps and putting together the debt snowball to kind of work the plan. Maybe your vision is to create a legacy and family and children and the right heart attitudes and characteristics in your family's life. Maybe your vision is to win the Super Bowl, Kansas City Chiefs plus 14. Just saying it again. Here's the deal, though. When it comes to vision, you have two choices. You can either follow the vision that's given, or the vision that you create. And I think that's what Nehemiah does so well in this book, is he's going to create the vision with God, and he's going to work an incredible plan. This is really about kind of a corporate and a personal vision that Nehemiah has. And I'll just say, if you're a part of this church, you might already know that we as elders are working to create kind of a vision for this church, kind of the 10-year vision plan. And this series, I don't plan to roll that out. We hope to have that established for you by the time we get to our annual meeting in May. So you can be praying for us. We're working really hard to put that together. But this series is really about your vision, the vision that God gives you, to carry it out, to own the vision. And this is where Nehemiah, I think, can be a great help to us. Nehemiah is going to unite a group of people around a task that is far larger than himself. See, I think this is the problem. I think a lot of people, they think they have a vision, but their vision is actually too small. And the litmus test is, your vision is too small if it doesn't really need God. Nehemiah desperately needs God. Let me tell you kind of where things are at. This book is set in 445 BC. And the people of God, the Israelites, are in slavery. They were captured by the Babylonians. In fact, if you were here with us last week, we were studying the book of Daniel. Daniel actually begins kind of what we call the exile. The people of God are captured by Babylon, by King Nebuchadnezzar, and they are hauled off from their homeland in Jerusalem to Babylon. Babylon is very effective at destroying, or mostly destroying, the Israelites. They destroy their king, they destroy the temple, they take all the worthwhile artifacts, the Ark of the Covenant, the candles, they take all of that out of the temple and bring that back to and put it in their temples of their pagan gods in Babylon. They even try to destroy the youth, the future of Israel, by taking their young leaders, young men like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, young, bright leaders of Israel, and they bring them back to Babylon and they indoctrinate them in all the ways of Babylon. It's literally brainwashing. Many don't make it. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar is evil. He just kills people for not bowing down to him. He throws them in the fiery furnace, or he throws them in the lion's den. He executes a great number of God's people. And so it's a really tough time for God's people. But the Babylonian Empire doesn't last forever. In fact, it only lasts for 70 years. And then Persia, a greater empire, comes in and conquers Babylon. And yet the people of God are still slaves. Now, the Persians are much nicer. In fact, King Artaxerxes begins to allow the Israelites to come out of captivity. In fact, the book of Ezra tells of the time when the people first go back to Jerusalem. And they rebuild the temple. Not very many, but a small group go back and they start to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. But God's city, Zion, the holy city, is still left in ruins. And this is where Nehemiah comes in. And what you're going to read is you're going to read here Nehemiah's diary, kind of like straight out of his day timer or day planner. And these are his personal thoughts on how God is speaking to him and giving him this vision. Nehemiah, starting in chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hananiah, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem." Now, a lot of things here in this first verse. In fact, you learn that Nehemiah is in the citadel of Susa. Now, that's just kind of fancy language for saying he's in Persia. The citadel, the capital of Susa, the capital of Persia is Susa. And he's working there as kind of a government job. In fact, we'll read at the very end of this chapter his job description. And I'll give it to you now. He is the cupbearer to the king. Now, that seems kind of strange. Like, well, what's a cupbearer? Well, it's actually a really good government job. What you had to do all day long is be a taste tester for the food before it was given to the king. Now, it's actually pretty good because the king ate really, really well. Now, in that day, the way it worked was the people would come to the pagan temples. There were hundreds of temples, and they would bring their cattle or their sheep or their goats, and they would slaughter it, lay it on the altar, and they would worship these fake pagan gods. And then that food, the best of that food, would be given to the king, would come to the king's table. However, if you didn't like the king very much, there was a prime opportunity to kill the king. All you had to do was poison his food or his drink. And so Nehemiah stood in that gap. He would taste every food that came before the king. Every cup of wine would be his first. If Nehemiah didn't feel so well, then all of a sudden the king wasn't very hungry. It was still a pretty good job because it was rare that kings were killed this way. But here's why I tell you all this. Nehemiah is just a regular guy working a job. I mean, he's just a dude working a job. He's not a prophet. He's not a priest. He's not a pastor. He doesn't have a fancy degree. He's just working his job. And this is what's so important, is God is going to birth in him this vision. And this should begin to show us the way in which God works. God will take anyone who's willing. And he will take their skills and abilities, no matter how underdeveloped or developed and overdeveloped they are, and he will use them for his greater glory. But really, the book of Nehemiah revolves around this question, this heart that Nehemiah has for his homeland, for Jerusalem. So he asks his brother. His brother shows up in the city, and he asks him, "How is the Jewish remnant that survived the exile?" Now, what he's referring to is, how are the people doing that are still alive? those that came with Babylon and survived Nebuchadnezzar and now have maybe made their way back to Jerusalem, this small fraction of our nation, how are they doing? The ones that weren't killed, that weren't fed to the lions, how are they doing? And here's the response. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." The people from the remnant, those who are in exile, are in great disgrace and trouble. They're not doing well. Why? Well, the city of Jerusalem is still unprotected. I mean, the temple has been rebuilt and is being kind of in the process of being put back together, but the city had no protection around it. Its wall was completely torn down. I mean, think about it. They'd been taken over by Babylon and by Persia. What would stop the next great empire from ruining them? They had no protection. Today, we have things like Homeland Security, and we have branches of the military to protect our borders. They had a wide open city. There's no wall. It says that their wall has been broken and their gates have been burned. It'd be like East Lansing after a Michigan State victory, which is kind of rare these days. Ouch, that hurts, right? But this is now beginning to be a problem and a concern for Nehemiah. Watch what happens to his heart. "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." And then when he hears these words, it's just devastation. I mean, this man is completely ruined. He sits down, he weeps, and he prays, and he fasts. It says for a period of days. I mean, this is devastating to him. But it kind of hit me this week when I was reading through this that something else is going on for Nehemiah. Because this is not new news at all. In fact, if I give you kind of the timeline of what happened, the exile started in 586 BC. That's Daniel. That's the book of Daniel. But now it's 445 BC. Some of you are like, "Pastor, I did public school. What does that mean? What's the math on that?" That's 141 years. And Nehemiah is crying. He's weeping. It's like he's watching a Hallmark movie. I mean, I'm not making light of it, but it's 141 years ago, right? I mean, doesn't that seem just maybe a bit odd? One of the theologians I was reading said in his notes, he said, "It seems a bit late, doesn't it? It just seems a bit late." This would be like if I showed up today on camera and I said, "Hey, church, I got some really devastating news. Here it is. Abraham Lincoln has been shot." And I started to cry and break down and fall on my knees. You would be like, "What a kook. What is wrong with that pastor? I mean, gee, thanks, Ron. I mean, yeah, I know. I mean, that happened like 150 years ago. I read about that in ninth grade history. I don't have a whole lot of heartbreak for it. I'm not attached to it. I'm kind of over it, Ron." And here's where I think something is changing in Nehemiah. Because what's happening is, I don't think he's getting new news. I think he's getting the news he always knew, but he's deepened in his concern. It's a concern for God's people and a concern for God's glory. So he prays and he fasts and he mourns. In fact, we'll see next week when we pick up in chapter 2 that this goes on for 4 months. 4 months of his heart just being broken. I think really simply I can relate to Nehemiah. Because all he wants is he wants for his people to be safe. And he wants for his people to be able to worship God freely, to be in the temple and have the gates and the wall restored around them. That's all that he wants. He wants God to receive all the glory that God deserves. And so Nehemiah is going to go into kind of what I think is his default mode, you know, kind of like what he does best. And what that is that's prayer. Nehemiah is going to pour his heart out. He's going to plead with God on behalf of his people for this situation. And he's going to pray. In fact, the book of Nehemiah records 12 prayers that he gives. They're longer prayers, but it shows his heart. And this is, we're going to read one of them right now, starting in verse 5. This is his prayer. He says, "Lord,
the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then, even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. This prayer is passionate. It's full of just asking God to do what only God can do. And it also comes from a place where I think Nehemiah is just being humble. He's just being a servant. In fact, in that prayer, 8 times, the word servant is mentioned. He's a humble servant. In fact, that fits him for his job right now, cupbearer, right? He's got a government job serving the king. But this is really humble service, right? I mean, he's going to go to the king, and he's going to ask for a leave of absence to go and rebuild the wall. Think about that. He is willing to leave the pleasures of the palace. He's willing to leave all of the fine dining, the wine of the month club. I mean, whatever you want to call it, he's able to leave all of that to pursue this vision that God gives him. This is so humble. This is so pure for him. And he's owning it, right? In fact, in his prayer, part of him owning this vision is he begins to pray this prayer of confession. He knows that what separates him from completing this vision is the sin that's been committed. The sin that's been committed by God's people, the Israelites. And so he starts to pray and he confesses the sin of his people and of his father and his father's family. You think about that. I mean, Nehemiah wasn't even around when Babylon took over Jerusalem. I mean, he wasn't even a part of that. And he's owning the sin that he didn't even commit. And yet he knows this is the hurdle. This is the first place I must begin. I'll tell you guys, I probably get it wrong more than I get it right. But I know that vision, when I've heard from God, when I've seen from God what it is he wants me to accomplish, it's always something that has been bathed in prayer and honest in confession. Bathed in prayer and honest in confession. That's vision. I hope on this day, as you hear these words, that something just sparks in you to kind of have this safe place, that you have people that you can just be honest with, that you can just be open with, that you can confess what's going on in your life. Just people that you can be transparent and say, you know, this is what's going on, and this is where I need help. This is where I need maybe some guidance or some protection. I need accountability. I need guardrails in my life, so I don't keep stepping in the same problems. That's Nehemiah's heart, just one of honest confession. And this begins to kind of move in him this direction that we're going to pick up next week. But I wanted to just really kind of pause there and begin to ask you to do the work of understanding the vision that God's given you. And I think a couple questions can really help shape our vision. This is a great book for studying kind of personally, personal leadership, personal servant leadership. But really, what is that vision God's given you? I think the first question that we learn from Nehemiah is, how are the people around you doing, really? Like, are they just simply surviving, barely? Or are the people around you really, truly thriving? I mean, like, really doing well. And do the inventory close to home. Start with your spouse and your kids and your cat and your dog. Well, at least your dog. Check in on your dog. And then, I know, check on your extended family, your mom and dad and your brothers and sisters. But what I'm really asking is, how are your Christian brothers and sisters doing? I mean, do you know? Have you checked in on them? I mean, maybe the people that are close to you here at Bridgeway. Have you checked in on them to see how they're doing in their faith? Are they struggling? Are they doing well? How have you, maybe even people in your neighborhood that you know are believers, and maybe they go to another church, but you share this relationship in Christ with them. How are the people around you doing? I've seen so many reports and firsthand the experience of what this last year of COVID and coming out of the pandemic has done to people of faith. In fact, one piece of research said that 3 in 10 Christians would say that COVID has strengthened their faith. That's a good thing. But then it said that that means that 7 in 10 have either weakened or just simply been stagnant in their faith. It's of no surprise that people in their faith journey are struggling. In fact, when you look at church attendance, in-person gatherings are probably around 25% nationwide in attendance. It's being projected that 2021 will see 3,500 churches close their doors for good. They do a pastor confidence rating index, and 50% of senior pastors do not think their church will make it this year. Now, this isn't about me, and this isn't even about Bridgeway. I couldn't be more excited about our future. I think we have things going. God has things going in the right direction for us. But like Nehemiah, I care for the church at large. I care for all people of faith, whether you're a part of this community or a part of any other community. And so I want to take a moment and just kind of get real as a church and as your pastor. Like, I want to ask you, have you checked in on the people around you? Now, if we were at church this morning, I would ask you, to look around. And if you look around, I would simply ask you, do you see people that are missing? Do you see some people that you know are part of this church that you used to worship and sing and lift up God's name here and you don't see them here? Those are the people to begin with. Have you checked in on them? How are they doing? Some of you are pushing back on this and saying, well, Pastor, come on, that's your job. Well, thank you. I have some responsibility that way, but certainly the pastor's role is to equip the people for service, for caring for one another. This church, we were running about 650 people pre-COVID, about this time a year ago. And since COVID, we're running in average in-person gathering about 150 people, many more people online, but it's hard to count online numbers that way. But it's easy to say that some people just have been missing in this community. And I'll just tell you that to think that one or two or three pastors can keep up with 600 people is a recipe for failure. And what really is needed is for the church to care for each other. I mean, I'm all for being together in whatever way is safe, whether that's in person or over a Zoom call. And so I just simply want to tell you that we are here for you, but we need everyone to be reaching into the lives of the people around them. I've seen the devastation. In fact, when we shut down in March of last year, I did it because we needed to be a good citizen. But when we opened up and then the health department again asked us this fall to close down again, I said, no, I wouldn't do it. I've seen so much damage. And when we opened back up, I saw how the health spiritually and mentally of our people were doing. And my job is to protect the sheep and shoot the wolves. And my protection would be, we need each other. We need each other now. And so I'm just calling you. I'm asking you as a church to reach out to the people around you and to check in on them. How you doing? How can I pray for you? How can I just maybe just kind of carry your burdens and walk alongside of you? Just be a friend and help you through what could be a season of loneliness. I think that's the first question of vision. How are the people around you doing? And then the second question, and we're going to ask this question throughout the series, and it's just to say, what's your vision? What's the vision God's given you? Now, I think sometimes you can hear that question, you can think that your vision is too small, but you can also maybe have kind of this failure to begin because your vision just might be too big. You might be sitting here thinking, well, Pastor, it's not really a vision unless it's something really, really big. Like you're sitting here thinking, I got to come up with the next Christian Tesla. I hope you do. But maybe that's not the vision God gives you. No, I need to have the next Christian Facebook or whatever it is. And maybe what God wants is just humble service, just to begin where you are and start small. Maybe the vision God gives is to just to be open with Him and just to be consistent and a time with him every day when you just talk to him. And I'm confident that when you talk to God, we call that prayer, that God will begin to give you the next steps of the vision. Maybe it's opening his word and just having a consistent pattern of reading his word. Maybe it's saying, you know what, part of the vision God gives is I need to read this whole book. I need to know the story. We're looking at God's people, the Israelites, but I need to know the whole story and how my life intersects with it. Maybe the vision is bigger. Maybe the vision is to leave your job and to start a company, to start a nonprofit, to support something of way greater significance than what you have in your life to this point. Whatever that vision is, I want you to begin to seek God and to clarify that vision. Write it down and begin to step into what it means to own that vision just as God's person. In fact, Nehemiah's vision started with this heartbreak for people. And Jesus had the same vision. While Nehemiah's vision was to go and to rebuild a wall, Jesus' vision and Jesus' heart broke for lives that have been torn down. And we have the same opportunity to do that as well, to come to Jesus because he is the ultimate builder and repairer of all lives. And so I just simply want to close our time by praying for you and for lifting up every single person. So if you would bow your head and pray with me, please. God, I just pause and I thank you for the life and the story of Nehemiah. I pray that his life and the vision that you've given him can begin to just unleash inside of us the vision that you birthed, God-given vision, unique and special to every person. God, would you help us to do that? Would you help us to do that in a way in which it's clear that it's from you and it's aimed at the care and the compassion of the people around us? God, your word says that without vision, the people perish. And so I just pray that we would stand in the gap and that we would be a church that's truly thriving in our connection with you to the world that so desperately needs you. We love you and we praise you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.